The Subcommittee on Criminal Law have come to order. The first item on the schedule is possible reconsideration of Senate Bill 568. We're not going to do that. That's an error. We just need to bring that up before the full committee or Thursday or Friday for referral to budget. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3491.
I think it's Ms. Mowat.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3491 creates a new crime of disorderly conduct in the first degree, making it a Class C felony. What this essentially does is it is intended to cover bomb threats and other similar threats in schools, and the bill goes on to make conforming changes because there is already on the books a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge. So it creates that as disorderly conduct in the second degree and makes a few conforming changes as well.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Naso and Mr. Johnson, scheduled to testify. Good morning. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, go ahead. Yeah. Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ron Naso. I'm the superintendent of the North Clackamas School District, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. In one sense, we encouraged our Representative Hunt, to put this bill forward. I apologize for not having printed remarks, but I got this notification yesterday at midday, and we had graduations last night, so I hope you'll bear with me. I'll try to make this brief. I just want to tell you a quick story about an incident that occurred at our Rex Putnam High School this fall. We were the recipients of a bomb threat that came to us on a Tuesday afternoon. We went through the normal protocol that we go through in that process. It was a written bomb threat. We called in the police. We did building searches, etc. Declared or determined that we felt that the threat was not one that had credence. On the following, I should say that information about that bomb threat did in fact get out to the school community, the youngsters in the school. We weathered some of the community concern. On Thursday of that same week, we received another written bomb threat from what we judged to be the same person. And as a result of that threat, we ultimately closed school on Friday of that week in order to be certain that our buildings were that the building and the campus was free of bombs. On the following Monday, we held community meetings and received a third bomb threat. Basically, what happened to the North Clackamas School District, or at least Rex Putnam High School, was for a week, education, as we think it should operate in that school, was effectively shut down. We had attendance rates that ran between 75% and 80%, even though we tried to tell the community that we felt everything was safe. We actually closed school on that Friday. And we went through a period of about 3 weeks, quite frankly, of a great deal of emotion, recrimination regarding the schools and their ability to handle these bomb threats. All of this ended with actually apprehending the culprit in this situation about 3 weeks later. But all of this bringing us to a point that crime, that disruption, if you would, that act that created such a problem in our communities ended up in a misdemeanor. And we feel that it is imperative that a message go out that this kind of act, which does disrupt what I'm going to suggest is sort of the fundamental core of a community, its schools, is one that demands a more decisive punishment, in the case of apprehension, and certainly demands to be treated as something more than a kid's prank. And in that regard, I would hope that we would support the change from a misdemeanor to a felony. I do want to say to you that certainly not all of life is about economics, but in addition to the emotional dislocation of the Rex Putnam community for a period of about 3 weeks, we estimate that we had direct charges, direct costs of about $30,000 as a result of this, and indirect costs that probably go much higher than that. When you think of it in terms of just the payroll of the staff at Rex Putnam for a day, where we essentially closed schools, sent them home, and we lost that day of education. So we think it has both a psychological and an economic impact, and we certainly would support the message of this bill that changes this act from a misdemeanor to a felony. I thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, please.
I'm Joe Johnson, president of Clackamas Community College, and our story is very much the same in the sense that we received a bomb threat on our campus that came in before we started, and the result was, and the bomb threat was that the bombs were to go off that afternoon. To search an entire campus without a specific site and to respond to that is almost impossible, and once you initiate the search, immediately everyone on campus is aware of what is happening. The result was that we ended up with fire trucks blocking our campus, the police, and the chaos that ensued is just indescribable in the sense that students had to evacuate buildings, leaving behind their backpacks and books, but then they couldn't get back in the buildings to retrieve them. And we spent the next 3 or 4 days trying to sort out whose backpack belonged to whom, purses, and all the various things that go along with that. The disruption in terms of the life on campus and the morale issues are just indescribable, and the fear that's created. But in our case, we too believe we were able to identify the person responsible for what occurred. But there's no prosecution coming forward in the sense that it's a misdemeanor. It is not something that really comes up on a police scale in terms of something they want to pursue or spend the time or energy. So in effect, you have public agencies being held hostage, and the consequences of an event like this aren't something that in law enforcement it really rises to the level where law enforcement can take appropriate action. So we're strongly supportive of House Bill 3491. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Dave Hunt, and it's my pleasure to join Superintendent Naso and President Johnson here. I don't think President Johnson actually mentioned the laws that were violated by him returning from the state capitol back to his campus that day to deal with the crisis, but maybe he didn't want that to be known. This is clearly one of these issues that has impacted not only just recently Putnam High School and Clackamas Community College, but really has had impact on schools across Oregon, and we really believe has potential to have even greater impact looking down the road. You'll notice that the legislation specifically deals in line 28 just with threats against schools. So it's not broadening this out to threats against anybody or any. It's just threats against that are located in or upon a school. You have a couple of letters before you, one from the DA's office in Clackamas County and one from the sheriff's office. Our DA is actually out on paternity leave with his first children, and so couldn't be down, and our sheriff is actually in the first few months of his service, so is pretty swamped. Let me just call yourself to a couple points in here. In the letter from the sheriff's office, I think the very last line really sums up the letter. Our office supports changing of the language, making first-degree disorderly conduct available as a tool to use by local prosecutors in cases where the situation warrants. In the letter from the district attorney's office in Clackamas County, I think a few things are worth noting. One, the start of that third paragraph, where it notes that the amount of harm to the community is not commensurate with the crimes available to charge in these cases, such as disorderly conduct, Class B misdemeanor, or initiating a false report, a Class C misdemeanor. And really talks about, as the gentleman before me have said, trying to match the potential charge and match the tools available to both the sheriffs in enforcing the law and the DAs in terms of charging those potentially involved in these crimes to match the level of crime with something that's commensurate with the actual crime itself. The other thing I'd point out in that letter is that next paragraph where it talks about the other practical difficulty with the current crimes is that they don't allow the courts to hold a dangerous youth in detention pending a mental health evaluation or resolution of the juvenile charges. They really believe that this legislation, House Bill 3491, gives them the tools to be able to hold a youth in the circumstances like Superintendent Naso and President Johnson have talked about for not only detention, but for evaluation, to make sure that they are not an immediate threat to the community, to make sure that they are detained rather than being out there committing future acts. As you heard from the example that Superintendent Naso gave, they had a series of threats immediately back-to-back, and unfortunately today the charges available to our law enforcement officers don't really give them the tools to be able to hold these youth in detention as much as they think would be appropriate. This all started off coming out of some examples of bomb threats, but you'll notice that the legislation in line 25 talks about not only threats related to fire, explosion, catastrophe, or other emergency, but we've also added on, at the suggestion of the Clackamas County DA, alleged hazardous substance threats, which in the era of increased anthrax threats around the country is a piece of statute that we really just coincidentally need to bring up to date. That was not the original intent of this bill, but we amended that in at the request of our DA. So I would bring this to you and request your support. There are some good answers among my colleagues here. I have no good answers, but I'm really just here to carry the water of my constituents in Clackamas County, and I think do it in a way that will really represent good public safety for our state.
Okay, thank you. Superintendent Naso, what was did you ever determine a reason why the person was calling those in?
No reason in particular. It seemed like an interesting thing to do at the time. Quite frankly, one of the reasons that we treated it as a threat that didn't have a lot of credibility initially was that we couldn't come up with any particular reason at that time of the year that things would be in play. During the court case, in fact, in this particular instance, while I don't want to go into the personal details of this, this youngster was actually incarcerated when it was determined that he was involved in the crime, that he was the perpetrator of the threats.
Okay. Yeah, are there any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Patrick.
Well, following up on your question there, on line 23 in the bill, it says, well, continuing on from, a person commits the crime of disorderly conduct in the first degree if, and it goes into the intent. And if you weren't able to, why is that in there? What, can't we just make it, maybe it's just an LC question or a question for the attorneys on the staff here, but why does the intent have to be there? Why can't it be just that they commit a crime of disorderly conduct in the first degree if they initiate or circulate a report knowing it to be false? And perhaps has...
I'll take that one. I think just as a sort of a general rule with a criminal statute, you have to allege at least some mental state. And so in this case... there has to be an intent to do something, and in this case, it's public inconvenience, annoyance or alarm, or creating a risk thereof. I mean, certainly it would not be difficult to prove from a prosecutorial standpoint that someone was knowingly creating a risk that there would be some alarm. I mean, it would not be a difficult thing to argue to a court or a jury, I wouldn't think.
I might also say, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, if you look at lines 6 and 7, the current language and statute related to the second degree crime, it has that same intent language in there. So this is trying to be parallel with the existing statute.
Right, yeah. I understand. Just also out of curiosity, are you able to pursue any civil action against these individuals that you apprehended or caused to be apprehended?
I think there is some possibility under the current law for the judge to invoke some monetary punishments. I suspect we can pursue civil action in this particular case, again, without wanting to go into the personal details. This was a young man in a family situation that would not have allowed us to recover much of anything in terms of monetary damages.
Well, then, actually, I do have a follow-up. So then what, I'm just wondering if this person would have been prevented or would have not followed through with their false report if they had known it was going to be a felony. Just wondering for accomplishment.
I have no answer to that question. It's always a hard one to speculate on.
I think in our case, the person would not have committed it if they had known it was a felony.
And that, I might say, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's basically the question that we came after the circumstance arose, went to our DA and our sheriff, and posed that same question, because we didn't know. I don't think any of the three of us knew exactly what the tool should be. This is the response that they came back with, saying this is the kind of tool that will be potentially good both for prevention as well as for detention and prosecution should those circumstances arise.
If I may just make one other comment that I probably should have mentioned in my remarks, I don't want people to think that this is a knee-jerk response to an incident. Certainly the North Clackamas School District, and we're no different than most other school districts in the state. In the 10 years that I've been here, we probably have an incident like this at least once every 2 years that disrupts a community. Prior to that, it was an issue at our Milwaukee High School that effectively closed down that school for 2 days, all because of simple bomb threats.
Okay, further questions? Representative McPherson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting to maybe what is the real issue here, which is how do we affect the conduct of people, generally youths, who don't understand the consequences of what they're doing. And I'm wondering whether a Class C felony with a 5-year prison term as the upper end potential is the right tool, or whether if the problem is that we don't have authority to detain them, whether we ought to be looking at the statute on pre-adjudication detention of youths, which doesn't include the threat to do something in the grounds for detention, but I'm just wondering whether that could be a more effective tool at getting at what we're trying to accomplish, which is to be able to get these people under control, make them understand the consequences of their actions, and shape their conduct going forward. Any reactions there for anybody on the panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. I think in general, again, none of the three of us are law enforcement experts. As we pose that question to the Clackamas County, our county DA, and our county sheriff, that they really looked at it, I think, in three different parts. One, the prevention aspect, having a high enough penalty to have whatever prevention impacts are there, recognizing that's not going to be true. I mean, you could have a 50-year sentence and it wouldn't prevent every circumstance, obviously. But to combine that prevention, the threat of a high enough penalty as a prevention aspect with also a detention aspect, as you noted, which that alone could be accomplished through other statutes, I would agree. But then having the actual penalty in cases where these folks do commit crimes that really do have a very serious, not only a fiscal impact, as Superintendent Aso reported earlier, but really do have a devastating emotional impact, not only on the students, parents, teachers, and other staff in that school, but really on the whole community. As you know, I'm not a huge fan of having big penalties for the sake of big penalties. This one, from my perspective, but especially from the perspective of our law enforcement officials in our county, anyway, seems to match the potential crime.
If I could comment on that, I have to acknowledge that as a superintendent, I'm conflicted on this, because part of what I understand is that, at least in a school setting, most of the bomb threats that we're going to receive are going to be coming from youngsters in the age range of 15 to 18. And my job as a superintendent of schools is to try to help young people develop, try to help young people to make intelligent decisions. So on that side of it, I fully understand that, gee, we've got to look at ways that are going to help youngsters to behave differently. But the other side of that, as a superintendent, is that I have a responsibility to my community. And believe me, until you have been in a situation that something like this, particularly in the post, I hate to use that phrase, but I use it in the post 9/11 era, the kind of emotion that gets generated in these kinds of situations, and then to have to stand before a group of about 300 parents, and that was my task on that Monday evening, mm-hmm. and explain to them that if we were able to apprehend this individual, that it was a misdemeanor. When I made that explanation to them, the reaction from my community was intensely negative in their sense of things. So I do like the language that is coming from from the police departments and from the DAs, that this represents a tool, not one that gets used in every instance, but a tool that helps in trying to keep this particular problem under control.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Guy?
Good morning, Chair Barker.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I will confess that I didn't come completely prepared this morning, as I missed this bill on the agenda. But what I did want to give was the alternative perspective, having practiced juvenile court for some period of time. I think it's important to, one, think about the fact that this is a felony conviction and that we're talking about juveniles. And I think it's important that we think hard about branding our juveniles with a felony conviction, especially when there are alternative ways to increase the seriousness of the response that can be made to something like this. And Representative McPherson has touched on that in terms of being able to detain a person right at the time. I think that studies show that the immediate response to and the immediate punishment to especially a youth will have the biggest impact. And so the ability to detain that youth when they are immediately caught would be important. We have, in recent sessions, amended the detention statute to allow for holding a youth where a firearm is involved. And we can make a similar amendment to the detention statute for a situation like this. The problem with a bomb threat is that this is something that's traditionally been used as a prank. And in this day and age, it's not an appropriate prank anymore. And it's something that should be discouraged, but it's not always going to be as serious as the Rex Putnam example that was given. And so my concern is that we not overreact in this situation, try a more measured approach, allowing detention of the youth, because it may be a situation where everyone agrees that this youth is not as much of a danger, it hasn't caused as much of an alarm to the public, and it can be dealt with as a Class A misdemeanor. So that would be my proposal, is that you allow detention, perhaps make it a Class A misdemeanor. The maximum penalty is a year. The youth can be placed on probation and ordered to do community service to repay for the annoyance to the community, and in the meantime, during that probation, they can be evaluated, and if the youth is dangerous, then they can be addressed, but not giving every youth who makes a bomb threat a felony conviction, I think, is something that's worth considering.
And they're talking about in the post 9/11 world, I would think this would be almost more in the post Columbine would be probably more accurate. And I remember seeing on the news at the time these occurred, the public was just really
vicious towards the school administrators about the whole thing, and I can certainly see their concern. But,
and Chair Barker, I believe that the amendment to the detention statute requiring detention of a youth who's found with a firearm was made in answer to that Columbine incident. That was the way that they dealt with it.
And you, so you're in a, did I hear you? So what you're saying is we would be, you believe we'd be better off if we would do that with the statute with regard to the bomb threats at the schools, the detention and evaluation.
Chair Barker, I think that if the goal is to be able to make clear how serious of an offense this is and to have an opportunity to evaluate the dangerousness of the student, that can be done without requiring that it be a felony adjudication, that can be done as mentioned by changing the detention statute, just as we did regarding firearms.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or further questions? All right. Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3491, and we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 548. I'm sorry, we're open a work session on 548.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 548 is sponsored by Senator Floyd Prezonsky. This measure would modify the crime of interfering with a peace officer by deleting language that was previously held unconstitutional, the subparagraph that makes it illegal to refuse to obey a lawful order of a police officer. It also adds two additional ways that a person could be convicted of interfering with a peace officer by either A, intentionally or knowingly entering or remaining a designated crime scene without permission of the peace officer, or B, by intentionally interfering with the peace officer who is lawfully engaged in the investigation of a crime or traffic collision. It provides that a person engaging in constitutionally protected activity does not commit the crime of interfering with a peace officer. The paragraph that is currently in the statute about intentionally preventing or attempting to prevent a peace officer from performing their lawful duties would remain a Class A misdemeanor unchanged. There are no amendments before you, and the measure does have a subsequent referral to state and federal affairs.
And as I understand it, we're not doing anything substantive today except passing this to the full committee, where the subsequent referral will be. It will just be sent to state and federal affairs without a further recommendation.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 548 to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
As a technical matter, we don't make a recommendation.
Okay.
It's just to the full with no recommendation.
Full, then.
Is there any discussion on that? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Olson can move that to the full committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 198.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 198 comes to you from the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's Sexual Abuse Task Force, Sexual Assault Task Force, excuse me. This measure would create a new provision of Oregon law allowing an alleged victim of a person crime, either a person felony or a Class A person misdemeanor, to select an individual to be their personal representative in order to accompany them to virtually all phases of a criminal case, the investigation of a criminal case, medical examination on a prosecution related to the underlying incident, but for a grand jury proceeding and child abuse assessments conducted at advocacy centers recognized by the Department of Justice. The measure would prohibit the court, law enforcement agency, or health care provider from excluding that personal representative from accompanying the alleged victim as authorized by the bill. The personal representative may not be a suspect in or party to or witness in the alleged crime, and the person must be over 18 years old. The provision gives, the measure gives the law enforcement officer, child protective services worker, the ability to exclude a personal representative if it is believed that the person is interfering with the process. There's also a grant of civil and criminal immunity to any official who decides to exclude a personal representative. And there is a provision that makes clear that the fact that a personal representative was either allowed or not allowed to accompany the person may not be used as evidence in a criminal trial. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Ms. Schenkel and Ms. Barkhurst.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, legislative liaison to the Attorney General. Staff are passing out my written testimony on behalf of Attorney General Myers, who is unable to be here. I'm not going to walk through all of it because I know certainly that you can read the materials. I will just point out, since this is the first sexual assault task force bill that we've had before this committee, that in my written testimony you have some history of our task force. And briefly, it started in 1999 through the work of a group of victim advocates. There was involvement on the part of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and ultimately the Attorney General agreed to form this task force, which has been in operation since that time. You can see that the mission of the task force is to develop and support an effective, consistent, and collaborative approach to the response and reduction, the responses to and the reduction of both adult and adolescent sexual assault in Oregon. We have listed in the testimony the activities of the task force that they're involved in. One is part of the ongoing law improvement of our department and looking specifically at laws in this area. You can also see the activities that they have been involved in. As your staff mentioned to you, this bill did have some amendments in the first chamber. Those were the result of compromise. The Department of Justice worked with Phyllis, who will testify next, as the director of the Attorney General's Task Force. We worked with the District Attorneys Association, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Oregon Law Center. We have members of those organizations in the audience if you have questions for them today, but we are here in support of the bill, and I'll turn it over to Phyllis to tell you a little more about it.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Phyllis Barkhurst, and I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, here to talk about Senate Bill 198 and support of it. Part of the role of the task force is to listen to folks in the field when there are problems, especially if they're statewide and need a statewide fix. The issue that came before us was the idea of victims of sexual assault, as well as domestic violence and other persons' crimes, having very different experiences within their same community, town, jurisdiction, area. And it was very difficult for people to give victims the idea of what to expect after their crime, whether or not they'd be allowed to have someone with them for an interview or for an exam, whether or not they'd be allowed to have support when they went in and met with the district attorney, all of those things, because it was left up to each individual responder. And in each agency, the response was different, let alone agency to agency or county to county. And then we had cases where it, clearly folks who were caring of victims, obviously their standard was to allow people to have an emotional support person with them. What we found was that folks in different response agencies who might not be as caring of victims were the ones who were more likely to be the problem and who weren't allowing somebody to have an emotional support person with them. What we know about victimization is that you can help mitigate the trauma if you allow folks to have support in the aftermath of these crimes. And we're talking about the most humiliating crimes of sexual assault and crimes of domestic violence, where most people we work with have never had experience with the criminal justice system, don't know what to expect, and are very afraid of the process itself. In addition, most people who experience sexual assault never report it at all. And one way we as advocates are able to really encourage folks to come forward is by letting them know there'll be somebody there to support them throughout the medical and legal process. So this bill is in intent to give some consistency across the state and to allow victims to have that emotional support person and to allow advocates to let victims know what to expect as they go through the criminal justice system in these very difficult crimes. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, may I have one?
Yes.
I guess I'm kind of a little miffed that, but I can see it too to some degree, that during an investigation that involved a sexual offense for a victim, that the investigator, the person who's doing the interviewing, would not be sensitive enough to feel that, you know, maybe to have a friend or a partner to be there, you know, just to kind of help them through that time period. But apparently, through your summit, you felt that that was necessary for this bill.
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, we found it was so inconsistent in that I would say certainly the majority of responders do have sensitivity, but there's enough of a critical mass of those who don't that we felt we needed to have such a fix.
Okay, thank you.
And will this help, like, have a checklist so people will be able to, so you'll be able to tell the victim here's what happens, and it'll, so it will be consistent, is that?
Yes, Chair Barker, that's the intent, definitely.
Okay. Questions?
Please. Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, I should add that Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center could not be here this morning because of a doctor's appointment. She emailed me some written testimony in support of the bill. I meant to bring that with me. I thought I did. It must still be on the printer in my office. I'll get you copies. But essentially, the Law Center supports the bill.
I was just handing the copy to...
Representative Olson has a copy of it, so we can enter his on the record.
Can I get a motion?
No. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 198 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Here we are. Are we? We haven't. I'm sorry. You're correct. We need to move to work session. No.
Okay.
I thought we were in work session.
Ditto.
Okay. Call the roll.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And I'll carry that one. Okay, so we're down to 243. And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 243.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 243 is the bill that was before the full committee last Friday, concerning the modification of the conditions of post-prison supervision and parole for individuals who have been convicted of a sex crime. And you'll recall that there was a conversation, the discussion that the full committee had over two issues. One was the term near in the first prohibition proposed by 243A, which is a prohibition from being present at or near the grounds of a school, child care center, playground, or other place intended for use primarily by children. And in Representative Garrard brought that issue up, and I followed up with him afterwards, and at his suggestion drafted the A5, the dash A5 amendment, which is before you, that would delete the word near and insert on property adjacent to. Representative Garrard felt that that reflected a more specific and concrete prohibition than the word near. So you at this point can choose to adopt that A5 or not, or if there's any other suggestion, I guess, for language that the committee has, I guess we could consider that too, and I could try to get that amendment drafted before the full committee. The other issue that was the subject of discussion at our full committee was the an issue brought up by Representative Worth, which was the difference between what is a place for use primarily by children, which is contains the outright prohibition, and the prohibition from being present more than one time at a place where children regularly congregate. And I shared with Representative Worth after the meeting, and it's probably important to put this on the record, that some of the discussion in the Senate Judiciary Committee out of which that distinction arose was that there are some places such as schools, daycare, the children's room of a library that are specifically intended for children, exclusively for children, and those are the sorts of places that at least the Senate Judiciary Committee felt it appropriate to have an outright prohibition for. And then the second category of places, that is the where children regularly congregate, are you know, contrasted with places like beaches, malls, restaurants, that while are not designed specifically for use by children, may under certain conditions and circumstances be placed where children are. And that's the sort of place that the Senate Judiciary Committee felt that a person might not be automatically on notice that a particular beach, for example, at a particular time is a place where children hang out. But if the person goes there once and realizes that, they should be prevented from going there again. So that was the reason behind that distinction.
Okay. Representative McPherson?
Did that seem to be resolve the issue that Representative Worth had expressed?
Chair Olson, Representative McPherson, yes, that did.
Okay. Council, I was just curious, Joe. We had some discussion earlier, too, about the whole idea and the concept of shifting over to on property adjacent to. And that was acceptable down at LC then.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, Representative Garrard's suggestion was actually to just use the term adjacent to. When I submitted that to LC, I got a little bit of pushback from Virginia Vanderbilt, the drafter, who told me that the term adjacent to has the connotation of property, contiguous property, and she didn't feel that that was appropriate to just use it straight adjacent to. I explained to her the concept that I thought the committee was trying to get at was to have a zone around these places that is a buffer, if you will, to prevent individuals from having access to children. And it was based on that she suggested the term on property adjacent to the school, the daycare center, et cetera. That, I think it's a policy decision about whether or not the committee wants to adopt language that is that specific. It is certainly more specific than the term near, and that might be a good thing for some reasons, and it might not be for other reasons.
There was a concern expressed by Representative Ackerman, too, about a constitutional issue and a vagueness about the term near. And I think I got the discussion a little off track by expressing the view that maybe it wasn't an issue of constitutionality when you're under post-release supervision, which I was corrected then later it actually is.
Oh, yeah.
But I think also the view was expressed that since the statute had not been challenged on constitutional grounds, that probably wasn't a problem. So I don't know that we need to make the change for constitutional reasons. I think the reason we need to at least seriously consider this amendment is that we may not have sufficient votes in the full committee to move it out, even though I think we're probably comfortable within the subcommittee in moving it even in its original form. At least I think I am. I'm comfortable that near is sufficiently specific.
Near is pretty broad. I mean, we had that discussion earlier, and I didn't share it during the full committee last Friday, but I was thinking, especially since you were trying to throw it out from your perspective and everything, I'm thinking from a perspective that it could have been a half mile either direction to some degree, but that was from a traffic view versus this being more criminal.
Okay.
Just maybe a question for council. Property adjacent to, does that include public property like sidewalks and roads? Or would the road be excluded because the sidewalk would be a separate piece of property? I don't know.
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, I think that's a good question. I think that one would have to look to the plain meaning of property. It doesn't specify public property. It doesn't specify private property. I think that means any property. Anticipate that I might get the question about adjacent, and I did look that up in the official common uses dictionary that the court relies on. And adjacent, defined in Webster's, means close to, nearby, next to, adjoining. Synonyms include abutting, adjoining, bordering, contiguous.
You mean near?
Near. So, I think my read of it is near is going to be more broad, and it's going to give on one hand the individual who's subject to the prohibition a little bit less notice of exactly where they can and cannot go, but it's going to give the supervising official more discretion about maybe different contexts and circumstances where they feel it's appropriate to prohibit. And then on the other side, you have on property adjacent mm-hmm. to, which gives the person more notice, gives the supervising officer more notice, and is probably more tight and more specific. So it's a policy call that you can make, or we can come up with another word.
And the parole officer still can give written permission to be anywhere. So
that is that's a very good point, Chair Barker. There is all of this is with written permission of the parole officer. I should add Michael Washington is here from the parole board, and I don't know that he will appreciate me putting him on the spot. But if the committee has any questions, maybe about what the common practice is. That might be helpful to you or not.
Maybe that, but I also have another question for you. It seems like if we adopt the adjacent verbiage, I could just see somebody just standing across the street from the school saying, hey, I have a whole property in between me, or standing or living across the street. I mean, who knows? I mean, what they can interpret and say, well, now I am not on that adjacent property, I'm next to the adjacent property, and therefore technically I am okay to be here leering at children. Whereas if you put the near language in there, you've got more discretion from the supervising authority to decide what that means for that individual.
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, I think you're absolutely correct, and I think the trade-off is if you go with near, you run the risk. I don't want to quantify it, but you run a risk that it could be subject to challenge in the future, and you have less of a risk if you go with adjacent to. But for the here and now, you give much more discretion to the supervising officer if you go with near as opposed to adjacent to.
I would think a parole officer could say, though, across the street is still too close, is adjacent to. I mean, he would be still able to control that in those situations.
I represent Chair Barker. I think it'd be subject to interpretation. I certainly think that adjacent to could be easily interpreted to include across the street, just because there's a street between the school and the property that is adjoining. I mean, I think that even under property law, I think a property across the street would probably be considered adjacent to.
Okay, me. Discussion. Would you like to testify?
No. Okay.
Well,
I do have a question, actually.
Okay, could you come up, please?
As well, I mean.
Someone's here.
That's why I take advantage of you while you're here.
Okay. Michael Washington, with the I'm chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, I'm just kind of curious, when you set restrictions sometimes for offenders, do you identify in the agreement or the restriction for what we're describing here, a specific distance? Like, I'll give you the example, you can't, possess drugs, you can't manufacture, you can't distribute that type of thing within 1,000 feet of a school. Do you do anything like that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, not in the circumstances regarding this statute and with sex offenders, but we do impose special conditions as it relates to victims of crimes where we will tell the offender that they are not to come within 1,000 feet of where the victim lives, where they go to school, where they go to church, or within their vehicle.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a strong preference between the two. I'm comfortable with near, but it may make it easier to move this thing through the full committee if we make the use the adjacent to. So I'd suggest one of two options. If the sense of the subcommittee is they still really prefer near, we could take it back that way with the amendment available so that the full, if they preferred it, they could adopt it. In order to move the bill, or if there's a preference on the subcommittee by some members that we have the adjacent to language substitute, I could happily support that to move the bill.
I would suggest that we actually go with the new language.
Okay.
I think it would simplify it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Okay, we're in work session. You want to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion that we accept the
dash five
amendments.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Then, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 243A, as amended by the dash fives, be moved passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Session. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative McPherson will carry. Further business. Adjourned.